We'll call this meeting to order. We do not have a quorum at this point. As soon as we do, we will break back in and officially call the meeting to order. The plan for today is to look at House File 1801. We'll be looking at, we'll have some more testimony. We've had quite a bit of testimony for the bill, so we'll try and keep things online here on time. We do have several amendments that we'll be working on, but we do want to hear from the people that are here today that have taken time out of their busy schedules to be here. So with that, Representative Linder, when we start up and when we have a quorum, we'll be moving to pass House File 1801, probably could be as amended, to the Civil Law Committee. So we'll take care of those details when we actually have a quorum. So with that, we'll just go right down the list. Then we'll have our amendments. Then we'll have questions along the way here. And we'll go from there. Nicole Kineski from Egan, if you could please join us. Okay. While Nicole's coming down, I will officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Linder moves that House File 1801 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Civil Law. And before we go any further, Representative Pugh moves the minutes of February 12th. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes?
Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are passed. Members, you should have the bill summary in your packet, and you should have the amendments that we'll be taking up. And I think we'll just go right in order. Question? Representative Stain.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, did we adopt any of the amendments on the bill, or is it still the original bill as introduced?
We, Representative Stain, we adopted the A2 amendment, so you could set that up to the side. That's an author's amendment, so that is currently on the bill. So we are actually working on the bill as amended at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stain. Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Nicole Kineski. I'm from Egan. I represent myself as well as other homeowners around the Twin Cities.
Welcome to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm here today to talk a little bit about some questions that I actually had heard last Thursday when I was here in terms of the confusion about what the root of the problem or the causes are. I've had an opportunity over the last 3 years to not only go through the situation myself, but also speak to hundreds of homeowners across the Twin Cities area, not exclusively in Woodbury. I'd like to start by thanking Representative Clinton for bringing this forward and members of the committee for agreeing to hear the bill. I took a little time in thinking, and that's where the little poster came from. I'm an elementary school teacher, so please excuse all the colors and the little scribbles. But basically, my bottom line in fighting for homeowner rights is that right now in the state of Minnesota, we have major issues with consumer protection in housing. And it stems from three places. We have defective materials being put into building systems, incompatible building systems with the codes, and defective workmanship that's going on in a number of levels. And neither of the three of these columns is to point at one specific person, not just the state, not just insurance companies, and not just material sellers. In effect, what's happening is defective dwellings all over the Twin Cities. I found it very interesting that we're putting a website together called Minnesota Home Watch, and I looked on the Woodbury home site, or the Woodbury City of Woodbury actual site, and they have a detailed list of what issues have been facing Woodbury since the early 90s. And I guess I'm a little concerned and a little confused with this amount of information why things have not changed for 10 years. And currently we're still seeing homes that this is happening in across the state. On the very bottom, you'll see reactions and results to the defective dwellings, which a lot of people were talking about in terms of finger pointing to insurance companies. Well, there's some things that consumers in this room need to know. Reactions and results from these defective dwellings are just a drain on not only individual people, but businesses, thus the economic stability of Minnesota. If you'll see the reactions by certain people, and I believe it would be builders and insurance companies, are agreements that are now being written called the Residential Warranty Corporation Documents, or HB 210s. And these, in fact, inhibit the 10-year statutory warranties that we are given as rights in this state. in addition to that, mandatory binding arbitration has no longer been a choice. I don't know if any of you are actually actively looking to purchase homes. I was out in the last year looking to actively purchase a new home or a new townhouse, and I saw that none of the builders would actually agree to sell me a home if I did not agree to RWC or HB 210 or mandatory binding arbitration. And that was homes ranging from $180,000 to $250,000. In addition, calling of builders' liability policies. This is a rampant problem. And we saw from testimony on Thursday that the direct result is builders being held hostage that actually want to settle these situations because there are not effective laws in place to force insurance companies to walk forward and settle their claims when they're selling liability insurance. In addition, overwhelming litigation costs is one of the final for both parties. And I think one of the best parts of this bill is it now does put us on an even playing field. Builders with documents they have forced you to sign at closing and some realtors already have those rights. It's homeowners, all of us sitting here, that don't have these rights. This has gone undocumented for 10 years. And when I say documented, I'm talking about the Commerce Department, building codes, city building officials, the Building Association. All of these people have known about this for 10 years. Something has to be done. This bill is a start, and I highly support this bill, and I'm aware that there are legislators not only in this committee, but other committees that are actively working on writing legislation to stop this, and it needs to stop, because all of us will suffer. Not just one person. I tried my best to keep it at 5 minutes to respect the other people that are waiting here, and I just want to close to tell you a personal dream that I have often after living through this situation. I'm going skiing in Lutzen, and I'm all excited because I just got my skis sharpened, and I picked my favorite hill, and I'm riding up the chairlift, and all of a sudden, the chairlift stops, shakes me off, and I'm hanging on by one leg. Looking at what, hundreds of feet below me and having no idea what the plan is going to be or how I'm going to survive this. The chairlift starts, I rip off my ski, my foot comes off with it, I somehow get myself back onto that chair and I get to the bottom and then I ride it up again and ride down the hill, and that's exactly what I'm seeing homeowners go through in this state when they're dealing with these issues, and it's an atrocity. And I'm here to ask you to make it stop. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Thank you very much. Nancy Johnson, Columbia Heights. Representative Finzig.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to highlight something that I had put in your folders today. There was some confusion as to who's insured and who's not insured in this process and which insurance is the liability insurance. So I tried to draw a flow chart to best demonstrate how this process works. So I just wanted to point that out to you in case there's any confusion as to where the general liability coverage is situated in the flow process.
Thank you, Representative. Okay, Nancy Johnson, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Nancy Johnson, and I live in Columbia Heights with my husband, Gary, and we're representing ourselves.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. The reason that I'm here is because of a situation we had in our home back in 2000 with our house being reshingled, and it involved a contractor who had 20-plus years of experience, but unknown to us, hired a subcontractor with probably less than 3 years' experience. And the subcontractor took the shingles off our roof. And that July day, we had about 9 inches of rain in the metro area. And in our house, we had rain coming in for 4 to 5 hours until it stopped raining. So we were mopping up water everywhere. And that sort of took us down this journey that a lot of people have gone on. And a lot of contractors coming into our home did not know how to take care of this moisture all the water that we had. And so that was in July. In August, my husband started pulling off baseboards, and he found mold behind the baseboards. The house wasn't adequately dried. People were painting over wet walls. And so we stopped all the work, contacted the Department of Health, which was just tremendous, and they led us to an expert in this area who really oversaw the mold remediation as well as the rebuild on our house. And that took about, we were out of our house. We moved out in September 2000, and we were out until June of 2001. We finally settled. We sued with our insurance company, all the other contractors' insurance companies, and we settled in May of 2003. I did provide to Denise at the last committee hearing, because we weren't able to, there wasn't enough time, sort of a written testimony, and if that could be shared with everybody, or I can provide another copy, I would really appreciate you just reading through this. One of the things that occurred as a result of this was Gary and I talked with our representative, Barbara Goodwin, and for about the last 6-7 months, we, along with many other homeowners and people involved in this whole process, have been working on legislation for homeowners as well. Gary and I had a chance to talk with Representative Klinzing after the committee hearing last week and told her we were thrilled that she, along with Representative Goodwin, are both working on issues to protect homeowners. And it is a major issue. It's a very expensive proposition. Our cost on our house, our assessed valuation at that time that we started back in 2000 was about $200,000. When the final costs were tallied, it was $360,000, and that included lodging for us out of our home for 8.5 months. The legal fees, we had to hire an attorney. The legal fees for us were about $20,000, and we worked with our insurance company and their law firm to recover costs. So it's a huge issue. But Representative Goodwin is going to be receiving the final changes, and I think has been talking with Representative Klinzing, and hopefully the parts that are compatible from Representative Goodwin's bill will be worked into Representative Klinzing, because there are a lot of good components that I think would fit nicely. And so, again, we're very grateful that they're working together on this. But instead of talking so much and specifically about Representative Goodwin's bill, I'd like to tell you, share a story. I was up in northwestern Minnesota. My family's from the Grand Forks area. And I met with another homeowner up there who went through what I think is probably one of the worst situations that I've heard of in the state of Minnesota. And I think if the health department were here, they would probably concur. And hers was not a new home. It was remodeling. And they added on an addition to their house. It was a kitchen, a contractor, a plumber. And there was a building permit. The contractor didn't contact the city building official to come in and do the inspection prior to completion, and that therein was a big part of the problem. And as you know, Representative Klinzing's bill has provisions for reporting to the state from municipalities, and I suspect that there will be cities that will probably want some of that changed, but I think that there are some good outcomes that could come from that. Anyway, with this house, this family, they have 3 children. For 9 months, the doctors up there thought that the children had mono. And so that's how they were treating them, this viral infection. They took them down to the Mayo Clinic and found out, the Mayo Clinic said this is related to environmental issues. So they called the health department, the clinic did, and they started working with the health department, who gave them guidance on how to deal with this. And essentially what happened is in 2000, oh, I should back up. This family, and I can say this because the family did not prevail, they had some attorneys down here, went to the Supreme Court for the state against State Farm. State Farm was their homeowner insurance. I don't know the details of it, but if you want to look at it, I'm sure you could get the opinion from the court. But State State Farm prevailed, and State Farm didn't pay one dime to this family. They didn't pay for any of their clothing. They lost their house. All their clothes had to be burned. The only thing that they could take would be dishes, pots, pans, things like that where you can clean them and be assured that there weren't any types of mold remaining. So anyway, they lost to the Supreme Court, and then State Farm turned around and filed a frivolous lawsuit against this family who had lost everything, had children who had been sick for months. There's asthma, there's memory loss, and this family, from the time that started until this fall, has had 8 surgeries. Who will say whether it's related to the mold or not? I suspect some of it is. Some of it, I don't know. But anyway, State Farm prevailed, and they filed a suit up in this community in northwestern Minnesota. And people said to the family, don't worry, they're not going to do anything if they have a judgment against you. You don't have anything left except a little money that they settled with from the contractor. By the way, the plumber was underinsured, and that's one of the issues that needs to be addressed here. That all the trades need to be looked at in terms of their insurance and their bonding because it's terribly inadequate. But anyway, State Farm swept all of their accounts, and they even swept the accounts that were tied to the children. So they took their babysitting money or any money that they had been saving. There was nothing left. So I asked this woman, I said, we're going to be attending a committee hearing again on Tuesday, and I said, if you had a list of things that you would like to say to all of the legislators that are going to be here, what would those things be? And I will make this short because I've already probably exceeded my 5 minutes, but here are some of the comments, and I think one of the first comments really addresses what Representative Linder talked about last week, and that was that every safety net that's available for people who are in a disaster, they fell right through. There was nothing. They called the Red Cross, and mold is not a natural disaster, so there was no aid available. They called the Salvation Army, but they had an income, so they weren't able to qualify. They didn't live around the area. They moved into a hotel. They racked up tens of thousands of dollars on credit cards paying for this. SBA doesn't probably recognize mold as a natural disaster, so thank goodness the interest rates are low right now. That helps when you have to borrow a lot of money in these situations to cover the costs until you get paid. The other thing she said was that their county has a mold task force. She understood that a number of counties were looking at setting that up, and that would be a great resource to people. Because really, who do you go to when you? I called our county. I called Anoka County. They referred me to the state, which I'm very glad that they did. But it would have been very helpful if there was either in the city or the county a task force or someone that said, "All right, here's the information we have for you, and this is sort of the process you need to go through." The other thing, and I think this is a big issue, is the medical. She said she would like there to be a medical protocol through the health department that would be provided to physicians all throughout the state. And again, her rationale and her reasoning for that is because for 9 months, her children were being treated for something that they didn't have. But this whole issue of illness and mold is something that's controversial. But let me tell you, if you want to know if you have mold in your house, you take somebody that's been through this, that's lived in this, and they're like a Geiger counter. And she can do that with her children. They'll go into a building, and they start reacting almost immediately. It's impacted them to that level. And so it's a cheap way to find out how safe your home is. And again, to evaluate and look at the Department of Commerce, to look at all of the insurance and bonding levels that are out there because real estate has gotten to be so expensive. And I think that probably is an area that really needs to be looked at to increase the insurance liability that's required and also any of the performance bonds or whatever those bonds are. Then the other thing was she talked about the energy and building codes, and I know that that's a very complicated issue as well. Then the other area that she talked about was in addition to licensing contractors, and something she told me, I haven't had time to check this out, But she said that if contractors come from communities with a population under 5,000, they don't have to be licensed, plumbers, and I'm going to look into that and talk with somebody at the Commerce Department, but that was a big concern of hers as well. And then the other issue, when she called the State Health Department, and they were very good, but they provide a list. They did this with us and many other homeowners. They provide a list of companies that work in this whole area of mold remediation, and they can't tell you anything about these companies. And these companies sign up on this list and, you know, say that this is their expertise. There's no certification. There's no registration with any professional organizations required. And so you really don't know, except when you start calling references. And there's a long list. And when you're in this situation, I'll tell you, everything comes crashing at one time. And so her thought and mine, I agree with her, is if there would be some sort of a licensing requirement for people in this whole field of mold remediation as well. And I personally like what the federal government does when they have anybody, contractors, small businesses, or individuals that have worked with the federal government and either been criminally prosecuted, I suppose, and they have a debarred list. The feds have a debarred list that you can go to if you're working with federal money to check to see if anybody you're working with is on that list. And it would sort of be nice if we had, like Bruce Brenn was recently convicted, I think, in a lawsuit from homeowners out in Edina, Orono, Minnetonka, that area, because he took their deposits that they put down on their remodeling or new construction, and instead of having it escrowed, which is not required by law, they went and spent that. He went and spent that money. And so all of these homeowners, there were, I think, 7 or 8 of them, and I talked with one of them. They ended up going to court, and I think Bruce Brenn is in prison now. Well, maybe he should be on a list somewhere in the Department of Commerce that says, you know, this man has been convicted because of the work, or, you know, because of what happened. And there was another contractor recently, homeowners from another part of the metro area. But anyway, I will conclude my testimony and just say that, again, we're very happy to see all of the work that's being done on this bill. And for Nicole and for I and a lot of other people, this isn't going to help us anymore with our projects because we're all done. There's nothing that can be done. But the reason that we're involved in this is because we don't ever want to see anybody go through the things that we all had to go through. And it isn't just new construction. It's remodeling. It's addition. It's shingling. And you just never know when it's going to strike. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. And I believe there is a question. Maybe it's for you, Ms. Johnson, if you'll stay up at the table. Representative Osterman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not necessarily for our testifier, but Representative Klinzing, in your work and your discussion with Representative Goodwin, are you addressing some of those things that our witness was talking about in terms of possibly having a list that people can refer to? Was that in, and I apologize, I didn't go through it, was that part of the assignment that would go to the commissioner's office to keep track of? I don't recall that as being an element that we had discussed the other day. Am I incorrect?
Representative Clinton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Osterman, no, that is not part of this bill, nor is it part of a discussion that I had with Representative Goodwin, but certainly something to consider for the future.
Okay. Representative Goodwin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask Ms. Johnson, Nancy, to tell the committee how much it ended up costing to have your home repaired and how much the value of your home was.
Oh, I had mentioned it a little earlier. It was, the assessed valuation was about $200,000, and the final costs, and we kept track of everything on an Excel spreadsheet, and it was about $360,000, which also brings me to another comment, and this is in Representative Goodwin's bill, and that is when there's a provision in the law right now that allows for a rebate on your property tax if you're for a residential property if your home has been destroyed 50% or more, and I called Anoka County. We filed the application with them, and, you know, I figured since we were out of our house for 8.5 months that, you know, that would probably qualify because the whole thing was gutted. And they said it didn't qualify. It wasn't a tornado. It wasn't a fire. It wasn't a flood. And our home hadn't been destroyed 50%. So they went to the board, and they denied the application. I have since emailed several other counties in the metro area and one outside of the metro area and gave them the same situation and asked them for a response. And a number of them said they don't deal with it. One said that they would look at it. It's all by discretion. And, you know, we had no use of our home for 8.5 months, and there are people living in their houses wrapped in poly on the inside, and they're looking to, and this is, herein lies another dilemma. They're looking to have their property taxes reduced because of the damage that's been done to the house, and yet there's a very big concern about the insurance companies taking that information and saying, well, now you say your house is only worth this much, so if we can't repair it, this is what we're going to give you. And it's, you know, it's an issue that I think has to be also looked at. But anyway, in our situation, we weren't able, and not only did they not give us a rebate, but because we had to tear everything out and put in a new kitchen, they said, oh, you have a new kitchen. So our assessed valuation went up. It was unbelievable, you know. So there are some issues, I think, that need to be looked at, and certainly that was a small one, but, you know, $1,600 would have helped us a lot in paying for all of the costs that we generally had to front end for the insurance company on much of that.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Johnson, for your testimony, and sounds like we really do have a lot of work to do on this. We've got Homeland Security. It sounds like it's time to have home owners security
in
some of these situations. Representative Maury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Johnson, I was just, are you? I have a question a little bit on this. What do you think of the issue as to whether individual cities or counties should be able to have stricter standards on licensing certain people? I remember a case 2-3 years ago I was consulted on and didn't get involved because I didn't have time, but it was a contractor whose license had been pulled, and then he put it in the name of his son, mm-hmm. and that was pulled, and then he put it in the name of his wife. And in the situation, the wife, of course, never appeared at the site. It was always the contractor whose first license had been pulled. State said that was okay, and apparently Minneapolis could no longer do something about that because of some changes in the 90s here where they had prevented that. Do you think that the city should be able to do more about that, as far as if the state is lax on who gets licensed on this, should they be able to have a higher standard?
Oh, I absolutely agree with it. The first line of defense, I think, is actually the Department of Commerce and also the Department of Admin. Those people were wonderful, but their hands are tied, and what the kinds of things that need to be done have to be legislated, and then they have to be enforced. The only reason those homeowners were able to sue Bruce Brand's group is because of legislative changes, I think, that you made 4 years ago, making it a criminal offense to do the sorts of things that he was doing. But I think anytime a city is more restrictive, and they're doing a better job probably of protecting homeowners, and but I really think, and I would really like to see, that much of that comes through the Department of Commerce so that we get some uniform sorts of requirements throughout the state in how that's being handled. And you have, there are wonderful people in both the Department of Commerce, the Department of Health, and the Department of Admin all of them were just great to help us. But so my first would be to have those restrictions come through the state.
Okay, I think we better move on if there's no other question for Ms. Johnson. Next on the list, we have Valoris Peterson. If you will come forward and take your seat there. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Peterson, will you state your name for the record?
Yes, my name is Valoris Peterson. I live in Minneapolis, and I've been a realtor with Edina Realty for 40 years.
Yeah, you may be seated.
I have a horror story that doesn't stop, and I'll try to be as brief as I can. I hear horror stories almost every day from other experienced realtors and from homeowners. Mine was a case of a seller. In fact, everybody lied. The sellers, the disclosure.
Excuse me, Ms. Peterson, will you just pull the mic closer to your mouth?
The seller lied on the disclosure. The inspector, who was an Ashi man, lied. The sellers, in this case, hired the people that I had hired, window people, and to testify against me. They subpoenaed them and paid them to testify against me. The inspector that I hired, I'll call him the Ashi man, was paid by the seller to testify against me. I had hired him. He testified against me. In the summer of 2000, there was an inspection done by an inspector in Minneapolis who pointed out several very, very important things to me. One was a staining on the lower level bathroom ceiling. I asked the seller about this, and he said he was unaware. What you see in these pictures is what was in that ceiling. It was seen by the arbitrators before the end of the arbitration. They chose to ignore it. I bought the house in the fall of 2001, and it was not ready. In 2000, the first inspection, it was not ready to be sold, so we had to have another inspection in 2001. When that Ashi man came, he didn't check much of anything. He did not check the plumbing. He did not check the mechanical work on the fireplace. And the first time I tried to use the fireplace, a 45-inch steel damper fell out of the pit, missing my hand by, I felt the breeze, so it was that close. A doctor told me I would have lost my left hand, wrist, or whatever, at least not been able to use it. Within the first 48 hours I was in the house, I had an extreme attack. I bought the house. I had built the house in 64, sold it to these people in 70. It was a great house. I loved it. And since real estate is my work, I really hoped someday I could buy it back, which I did. It was not habitable. I went to doctor after doctor after doctor because this. I had every symptom that you can imagine, from bloody mucus in the nose, bloody coughing up blood from the lungs, and everybody just, they sent tests to Rochester, they sent tests. I had inspections by Private Eye, Tamarack, Paul L. Ringer, detected it right away, the dishwasher and the refrigerator had been leaking, he said, for years. 2 months after I moved in, the ceiling in the lower level started staining. I had additional testing by Tektron Engineering, Derek Johnson. Did very good testing. The reason I had all these tests was that I was concerned. I wanted to be sure it was there. Dr. Doggett from Microbial Diagnostics did tremendous testing. Braun Intertech did testing. So I've had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Braun is coming back this coming Thursday. The rain was pouring in the windows. I knew that it needed a new roof, so we didn't claim for a roof. I did go through arbitration. I paid $15,000 for the arbitration, and they saw all of the problems and just chose to ignore it. One of the huge problems that really has bothered me is the fact that the seller had put in drains in my garage 13 inches, 4 feet deep, that went into the earth. Then he proceeded to pour his oil into those drains. My children used that garage for 6 years, roller skating and triking and all the neighborhood kids played in there. There were no drains. It was illegal in 1964. The house was designed by a famous architect. They're still illegal. I never see drains in garages in the city of Minneapolis. This is a tuck-under garage. The seller put them in. There was a slip made at the arbitration when Mrs. Sellers said, oh, there were metal caps, heavy metal caps on the drains when we came in. My husband put on wooden caps. The story is endless. So the second year, I had the same Ashi man back in 2001 to get an update on the disclosure on the truth in housing. And at that point, there was no realtor involved for the sellers because they knew they had a victim, and the victim was me. There was an attorney there that represented them, and while I was talking with the man I had hired, he said, why don't you do an inspection for the seller at the same time to save money and time? And I wanted to interrupt him and say, you know, this is probably a conflict of interest because the reports are very different. But I didn't. So I've lost my house. I've spent approximately $200,000 trying to make the house habitable. I have much more work to be done. Moldex, I had two remediation companies. One was very bad, and the second one is still working. They are the ones that uncovered all this stuff in the pictures. So after the second inspection in 2001, I had called Mr. Ashi and I said, you know, there was a severe slope in the garage and I'm concerned whether or not I'm going to be able to use shelving on the sides. So would you be willing to go back and check the slope that goes into these illegal drains? And he said, it's not necessary that you go with because he was just going to check the garage. So when he went back to check the garage, as I said, the seller lied big time. When he went back, he wrote a statement. Mr. Seller apprehended him and thought, oh, this is a good chance to get the illegal drains off my plate and on to her plate. So he put in his report, which was 5 days after the second inspection. It was August 18th, 01. He said that, and drew a big explanation, that those drains were part of the original design. At the arbitration...
Ms. Peterson, excuse me a second. How much testimony do you have left? We are going to vote on this today. We've got 4 or 5 amendments. But
okay, I'm just about done.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
And he said, reminds me, I forgot where it was. He said it was part of the original design, and at the arbitration, the architect testified, my daughter testified, and the arbitrators were shown a copy of the architect's plans. It was all ignored. So I have a problem with the system. And who is responsible, and how much can anyone suffer? I'm hoping that with this testimony, something can be done to help future buyers.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for the witness? Thank you very much. We'll now move on to Brenda Sorrow, attorney representing homeowners. And if you could please be specific to the bill, we'd really appreciate that. And then we're going to go to Mr. Whitcomb. Is Mr. Whitcomb here? Okay, and then we are going to give the Insurance Federation some time. The one side's had 2 days, so we will give the insurance folks 2 minutes or more if needed. And then we are going to vote on amendments. We are going to vote on this before we go today, members. This has a long ways to go, so we've got to get things moving. And I've got the amendments. So members, be ready for your amendments so you can describe them so that we can ask questions and then vote on them. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brenda Sorrow. I'm an attorney practicing in Eagan, and I'm kind of wearing two hats today because not only do I represent a number of homeowners that are facing these claims for moisture intrusion, but my own home is affected as well. So I come before you as an affected homeowner as well as an advocate for those who are in a similar position. And not to rehash what has already been said, but you should see by now that this is a serious problem. The people that come to my office have done nothing wrong. They bought a house assuming that it would have been built according to code, that the city inspectors inspected it, and that it was all done properly. I have not seen one house yet that we have actually removed the siding on that was built according to code. So when you're looking at is it the code to blame or not, I haven't seen one builder yet that actually followed the code. So that's kind of been a red herring that I think people need to be aware of. The builders, with the exception of Derek, are not responding. And Mr. Derek was here and testified, and it is true he is responding after he receives a letter from my office. But we are having some luck with him. Other builders are saying to the homeowners, sue us. We can't help you. Sue us. The statute was designed to provide the homeowner with a warranty on these homes, not for the builder to throw up his hands and say, sue us. And the hardest thing in my office is when the homeowner turns to me and says, but of course I get my attorney's fees back, and I have to say to them, no, not under the current status of Minnesota law. So if you, Mr. Homeowner, are looking at a $60,000 fix, if your builder really wants to be obstinate here and I have to take you through a jury trial to get them to do what they are obligated to do under the statutes, you're going to owe me about half of that fix. And that is a terrible position for these homeowners to be in. That's why I feel very strongly that there needs to be an attorney fee provision in for the prevailing party. That would protect the builder as well. If the builder is willing to fix it and the homeowner is being obnoxious and just wanting a new house built, then that homeowner is not going to be the prevailing party. But the homeowner has absolutely no leverage right now with the builder. The builder's attorney's fees are being paid by their insurance company. What typically happens in these lawsuits is we sue the general contractor, who then turns around and sues all the subcontractors, and they spend the next months pointing the finger at each other, all trying to lay blame. Nobody stepping up to the plate and saying, you know what, I didn't build the house right, and look at that dripping wet board underneath the siding, and I need to do something about it. I'm not seeing that response. That's why I feel very strongly that there needs to be attorney's fees here, and this would not be out of line with other states. I practiced in Colorado for 10 years. In Colorado, this sort of thing would be characterized as a deceptive trade practice under the Consumer Protection Code, and the builder would not only be facing attorney's fees, they'd be facing treble damages as well. In those cases, those things get settled. Right now, there's very little incentive. And what I'm seeing is the insurance companies taking advantage of that and trying to force an early settlement for pennies on the dollar. I have had so many calls about Zurich, so many calls about I'm getting offers of 25 cents on the dollar. What am I supposed to do? They're telling me it's going to be $200,000 to fix my home. They're offering me 50. So those are the types of things I'm seeing in my office. Those are the types of very real claims that are going on. I'm seeing cases where the builders say, yep, there's a problem there. We're going to fix it, going to fix it, going to fix it. And 2 years later, nothing has happened because of this whole finger-pointing scenario we've gotten into. So the homeowners are left there with a house that's not performing. Perhaps there's some health concerns going on. And then you've got statute of limitations issues running on these people. So the other thing with this particular bill, while I think it is a good idea for people to meet prior to litigation, if there's a way to suspend the statute of limitations or repose during the period of time of that meeting, I think that maybe that should be looked at. Because I just spoke to a homeowner yesterday who's been hearing from the builder for the last 2 years, I'm going to fix your home, I'm going to fix your home, it's in writing. The insurance company comes out, spends over 2 years adjusting the claim. They say to him, we're going to fix your home. And then 2 months later, he gets a letter and says, oops, statute of limitations. No thanks. We're not paying for the fix. That's unfair. That homeowner is in a bad position through no fault of their own. So I'd strongly encourage you to support homeowner protection. I would strongly encourage you to put some teeth into it so there truly is some protection for the homeowners. And I'd like to thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Representative Pugh, and then Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I do have a question on the attorney's fees. In the original version of the bill, if the homeowner prevailed, there'd be an award of attorney's fees. We adopted an amendment last week. We didn't adopt it?
Mr. Pender?
A2?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair, members, I think we did adopt the A2 amendment last week, which was an author's amendment.
Mr. Chair, in the A2 amendment, that provides that attorney's fees would be awarded if the homeowner prevailed and the vendor had refused to perform the vendor's obligations under the warranty without a good faith basis for the refusal. That's the language that's currently pending. What do you think of that provision for the homeowner? Does that
I think the homeowner is going to be litigating then again that provision. I think if you leave it to a prevailing party standard, that's something the courts are considering in other contexts. They're familiar with that term. There would be some case law behind it. What is a prevailing party?
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up with one other. Your experience is that the attorney's fees that the homeowner must absorb really come at a deduction. The maximum award you can get is the cost of the repairs, and whatever they pay you comes off of what they'd have available to repair the home. Is that right?
That's the way it works right now.
And one final question, if I may, Mr. Chair, Ms. Sorrow. Could it be possible that the builder would wish to resolve the matter, but in fact the insurance carrier would be unwilling to pay, so the builder could be in good faith hoping to have the problem go away, but in fact the financial carrier paying the bill might not agree to that? So is that a possible scenario?
That's possible, but I think in that situation then the builder needs to step up to the plate, make the fixes, and then fight it with their own insurance company. In Minnesota, the homeowner can't go to the builder's insurance company and sue them directly. They have to first sue the builder, get a judgment. If there's no payment, then they have to file another lawsuit against the builder's insurance company. Now, that can be statutorily changed, but without that direct avenue to the insurance company, I think the onus should be on the builder, who has the resources to go after their own insurance company, and in that case, maybe there's some contractual language that might give them the fees back.
Thank you.
Now, members, if I could, before we have a lot of these civil law questions, please remember that this bill is going to our subcommittee on civil law, where those issues can be hashed out there. So as far as the who sues who here, that's let's leave some of that to civil law. Representative Clark, Mullery, then Johnson. Representative Clark. Representative Pugh, were you finished?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I was checking to see if that amendment is adopted, and it is. I'm wondering what you might think about the provision in the amendment that gives 30 days to the vendee to respond to either accept, reject, or counteroffer. Is that long enough? You mentioned something about the length of time being an issue, and that's the language that's now on there.
Ms. Sorrell?
Again, it depends on the age of the home. I mean, if we're looking at my statute of repose is expiring in 2 weeks, those are a lot of rights that homeowner might be giving up by trying to go through a 30-day mediation process with the builder. In a perfect world, people could sit down and work this out, but what I'm seeing is the builder might be acknowledging the problem but not be willing to pay for it, and you're at a standstill.
Representative Park?
Thank you.
Representative Mullery?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm going to go into what the guts of the bill is, even though it may be civil law. And basically, if we don't remove that language, I think you would agree that there's really not much value in this bill. Isn't that correct?
That
if we don't take out the language about a good faith basis for refusal, because as you probably know, under the reverse where the contractor is suing the homeowner, there is no such a restriction.
Right. Right. No, I agree. I think it needs to be a prevailing party standard, which is something the courts are comfortable with. It's something that can be measurable.
And there is the word reasonable in the original bill's language, which is the exact same word that's in the mechanics lien statute, which the contractor uses against the homeowner.
Ms. Sorrow?
I would agree that we need to have a very narrowly defined criteria for the recovery of attorney's fees so the homeowner doesn't have to litigate that on top of the underlying claim.
Representative Mullery? Okay, members, we're getting into a bit of a time crunch, but of course you know me, I never cut off debates, so we're checking out to see if we can get a room from 4 to midnight tonight. We will finish this bill today. Representative Johnson.
Thank you for that preface, Mr. Chair. I'm not on civil law, so can I ask one civil law question?
Most certainly may.
Thank you. I just want to clarify something, Ms. Sorrow. The bill right now just provides for attorney's fees for a prevailing plaintiff, and you would be comfortable with a prevailing party standard as opposed to a prevailing plaintiff standard?
Ms. Sorrow?
Well, obviously right now my bias is towards the homeowner, just what I've seen. Historically, I've represented builders, and I did that in Colorado for 10 years. I think if it's a prevailing party standard, then it's fair. And I think then it's a way to measure it from both sides. If the builder is coming in and saying, I will fix your home, and the homeowner, for whatever reason, isn't accepting that, then I think the builder should be able to say, hey, you know, I shouldn't have had to fight this battle. But the opposite is true in most of these cases.
Representative Johnson?
No, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions for members? Representative Goodwin?
I do have a question on that particular point. You think it's fair if it's both sides, whoever prevails? The reason I'm asking that is because even with that, the insurance industry, the deep pockets, are in favor of the insurance industry and perhaps even the builder, depending on the size of the builder. The consumer still has to be very careful about what attorneys they hire and how much they cost in case they don't prevail.
Mm-hmm.
And that would still come out of their judgment under this bill. So, but you still, under those circumstances, believe that it's fair to say that the prevailing party gets awarded damages?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way the statute was worded with the prevailing plaintiff is the preferable language, I believe, in this case, because of the inequity between the parties. The homeowner is coming out of pocket a lot of money here, and the homeowners aren't creating this situation. Now, the builder would still have the groundless and frivolous already enacted protections in the statutes and the rules that if the case was frivolous, they could then seek fees under those.
Right.
But I like the way the bill is now.
Does that sound good, one?
You mean the way the bill was before this amendment was?
Correct.
Thank you.
Sorrow.
Prevailing.
Sound good, one? Okay. Any other questions for the witness? Thank you very much for sharing
your
testimony
Chair.
Today. A few announcements while Mr. Whitcomb is coming to the table. I would move that the House File 2044, the tourism bill, be referred to the Economic Development and Tourism Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So the announcement is then Chairman Linder's Economic Development and Tourism Committee tomorrow will be hearing the omnibus tourism bill from the department. Thursday, hoping it gets out of that committee tomorrow. I'm going to have to work a lot of members on that one. We'll hopefully get it back here Thursday, and we'll have the Pew UCC bill on Thursday and hopefully the tourism bill on Thursday if we can get it out of the committee or the Chairman Linder's committee. Welcome, committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is actually David Exe. I'm here because Mr. Whitcomb could not be present today.
David
Exe. E-X-E.
That's easy.
Coming forward, backward, okay. You got me.
Welcome to committee, sir.
And I am representing the National Society for the Preservation of Engineering and Architecture.
Okay.
And I have to apologize for what I'm going to introduce today because it is directly to the bill, but it's a can of worms. We've heard a lot. I was not here at the last hearing, but today we heard from individual homeowners who have single-family residences. I would like to put something up on the display board. Those are single-family residences. Approximately 100 that will be sold to individual people, and individual homeowners will own them. And they've got problems, too. And I don't want to go into the individual problems because most of them are similar to the ones you've heard. But what I want to address today is the system. The system is there to protect for the most part. The system is failing. And here's the truth. In 1921, the state enacted licensing laws to license architects and engineers. The statutes are 326.02 through 326.15. They give the ultimate responsibility and authority for the design and remodel of all construction in the state, including single-family residences, single establishments, to the Board of Architecture, Engineering, etc. We call them the Board of Lawlessness. That board has the authority and responsibility to enforce the law that licensed architects and engineers do the design and are held liable and accountable. Minnesota Statute 326.06 establishes that the board may determine which structures should be exempted. That board in Rule 1800.5800 established that certain residences, single-family, one-family, two-family residences, shall be exempted. These structures are not. So that building is supposed to be designed by architects and engineers. Just as hospitals, schools, apartment buildings, etc. are. The vast majority of them are not. We had a nice example today of our fire alarm system going off. How many of you know that this is designed illegally and installed illegally? And the state professional engineers have testified before the licensing board, they don't have one single legally certified plan of this entire system. Now, we go to the fact that when the plans are supposed to be designed by engineers and architects, they're supposed to be certified. I handed out a handout because there isn't time to go over everything. In there's a copy of this facility. In fact, there's two copies. The first copy is legal. Second copy is not. The difference is the absence of that paragraph in the lower center part that says, I hereby certify. Now, it would seem a very simple matter. All a building official has to do is look for that certification. it's there, the plans are legal. If it's not, the plans are obviously illegal and can't be used. But the billing officials have taken a different tactic. They have said that their rule, 1300.0130, their rule overrides Minnesota Statute 326.06. Their rule gives the billing official the authority to override the state licensing board and determine that that building does not need to have certified plans, and anybody can design it. You will find in the handout that I've given you some graphs and charts. Those are the best information that we can come up with. What it boils down to is that about 90% of the electrical life safety controls engineering in the state is done illegally. Now, I'll let that lie because it's obvious if you don't design it right, you can't build it right. There's been a tactic in this state to believe that the state codes, the building codes, are enough to protect the public. We can build a house to code, we can inspect it, and it will be safe. Industry learned decades ago you cannot design and inspect in quality, you cannot inspect in reliability, you cannot inspect in safety. Those functions have to be designed into the product. That is the same with structures. We found that there's two primary causes for mold into the house. Besides, naturally, if you have systems that are leaking and filling water into the house, and you have puddles of water in the house, but from a structural standpoint, one is the design of the exterior walls that allow moisture to penetrate through the vapor barrier or around the vapor barrier. That process is a function of design. It is not an architectural design only. It is actually primarily a mechanical design. Architects are not trained in hydrology. They are not trained in various levels of humidity and vapor pressure and how it migrates. Mechanical engineers are. But you will find that architects design the exterior walls to the exclusion of mechanical engineers. The other cause is that once the moisture is inside the house, I'm getting very thirsty.
Sir, how much longer do you have? We're on quite a time. If you could summarize your points quickly, please.
Basically, yes. There is a system to protect the public. That is licensed professional engineers and architects. They're being ignored. The building officials are by choice ignoring them and removing them from the system. That's one of your primary problems. They're removed from the remediation process. Once there's a problem, anybody that wants to can inspect. But the licensing laws are very strict. This law goes quite a ways to bringing accountability to that function. I have asked for some other additions. There will be more. If we don't bring accountability to it, this is but as broad as the moral problem is, it is the tip of the iceberg. Imagine when you turn virtually every control system in every facility in the state of Minnesota, that includes the Capitol Complex, it includes the most hazardous chemical facilities operating in the state, it includes every hospital and every school, virtually 100% are designed illegally. They're being designed and installed by the same company, now has total access to your facility, how it operates. They can plant anything they want in the ventilation system and release it anytime they want to. I'm not going into that. We're going to release a white paper on that, NSPEA is. Please get some accountability into the building process.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for the witness? Okay, thank you very much, sir. Mr. Bob Johnson, I do have room 5 secured starting at 4:30 till, I guess we got to stop at midnight. So With that, Mr. Johnson, welcome to committee, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
And in all fairness, it's been kind of all the one side, so we are going to show a little latitude to Mr. Johnson here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'll be brief because I don't think this is going to take too long for my perspective. There's three things I'd like to just briefly comment on and relevant to the bill and this committee's jurisdiction. The first, and there's not time here, but it's very relevant. It's the condition of the comprehensive general liability market for businesses, builders in particular in this state and around the nation, and the possible impact of this bill on the builders' liability insurance market. If builders can't get insurance, there's a raft of issues that they can address and have talked about. And let me just comment on that in a nutshell, is that the market's not in good shape, and it's getting worse. And that's not unique to Minnesota. That's true nationwide. And construction defect claims are directly relevant to the poor health of the general liability insurance market and the significant decrease in the number of companies willing to put capital into that business and to try to write it. And so it's not been good. And I think some of the issues have been discussed here and made clear. It's hard in a couple minutes to kind of distill it, but I'll try to. And I think but that condition is very relevant, and I know it's one that everybody here cares about because it's relevant to the building industry and construction in the state, which has been important and significant. I know insurance has been one part of it. It doesn't have to be, but it has been. The document that I'll refer to it, Mr. Chairman, and it's online, or I can get it to the committee, and I'd urge the committee to look at it. Liability trends, issues, and jury verdicts impact on insurance liability and excess casualty markets. It's an Insurance Information Institute October 2003, a rather extensive analysis of the marketplace, the companies, the profitability, the capital in that marketplace, and what are the factors driving price, availability, and what are businesses in this country experiencing, you know, Minnesota nationwide, www.triplei.org. I believe you can get it directly off that site. If not, I could follow back up with staff and make certain that the committee gets that electronically. So in any event, the liability market for builders is not good, and it's deteriorating. This litigation and these cases that you all have heard about for a couple of days are directly relevant to that marketplace. Secondly, just the impact of House File 1801 on that market, and there's other provisions in the bill that I'm not as familiar with and won't chat about, except one that I'd want to indicate that I believe is very positive and helps address the risk issue that insurers are trying to struggling with to deal with, to manage. You know, managing the risk, measuring the risk is at the core, because if insurers can't manage or measure the risk, they're not going to sell insurance. And that's, I can tell the committee, that has been a decided problem in the area of construction defects. From our perspective, the attorney fee provision on top of an already thicket, a mess of a litigation situation, is not going to improve that mess, and it is a mess. And I think the people that are in the situation and are going through this, there are quite a few details to that litigation that, you know, have not come forth. It's important, whether here or civil law somewhere, to go through that litigation thicket that is not avoidable. And that's the unfortunate reality. I think the general liability policy and how it handles construction defects, I think there are papers being written where the questions being asked is probably not the right product to try to handle that. Unfortunately, there aren't good options to it, but it's not working. It's not working to solve problems. It's not working to cover risk, and it's increasingly being a problem because companies aren't going to write this risk. And so, again, the issues that I mentioned and adding attorney's fees to that, it's already a thicket and an impossible situation, complicated by, in this state, last summer there was a Minnesota Supreme Court decision. I don't believe anybody's references, but anybody here that talks to civil litigators talk about the Minnesota Supreme Court coverage decision in the 3M case that directly deals with the comprehensive general liability policy and how does, you know, the court interpret that CGL policy for which policies pay when there's a multi-year, multi-party, multi-type of litigation. And unfortunately, that coverage decision, or the 3M decision by our Minnesota Supreme Court, significantly changed the ground rules as they had been interpreted and applied in coverage decisions and opened a number of questions that are today not resolved, which is going to further complicate the already deep thicket of litigation issues involving construction defect. And so I reference that, Mr. Chairman. I know this is not the place, but others can and should. There are CLE programs that are going to be conducted on the 3M coverage decision and its ramifications in every area involving liability determination. So that's the second point about House File 1801. We don't think it's going to contribute to that, and the liability lawsuit system is not producing the results there. Maybe that's the last point, because what I wanted to just end on is, and what should be done to respond to homeowners' concerns here, and there surely are legitimate homeowner concerns. You build a house, and it's been built to code, inspected, cleared, and you move in it, and the thing is rotting out. That's a problem. But the liability policy doesn't kick in unless there's been negligence or a defect. And as you've heard all of this testimony, it's not clear that there's been liability or negligence on a builder who's built to code. Now, there's some contentions it's not been to code, but let's assume it's been built to code. It's been inspected and cleared, and somebody moves in. There's not necessarily going to be any money that comes out of a lawsuit. So I'm just referencing to say I don't really believe that civil litigation is going to produce a remedy for many of the people that have testified here today. It just simply isn't. It's going to take a long time. And at the end of it, depending on how liability is apportioned, depending on how much percent fall is attributed to who, will directly affect whether or not there's any money and the extent of the money. From our industry's perspective, and I'll end with this, Mr. Chairman, is that I've been a part of, in this state, lobbying for quite a few years, and we have seen specific instances in Minnesota where the CGL policy and the coverage litigation around it failed. I mean, it just simply didn't work. You get into the thicket, and a lot of money gets poured down the litigating funnel, and no results come out of it for the individuals impacted. So have we dealt with that in the past in Minnesota? And the answer is yes, in some very specific instances. Petrol fund directly relates to tanks at old service stations that are leaking, but there was a lot of civil litigation related to and around those old policies. And frankly, it wasn't producing any results, which is fixing up the tanks. And so the state made a decision to say, let's create a different system to get money out to and fix the problem. Mixed municipal landfill cleanup issue in this state. Absolutely a mess of civil litigation regarding CGL policies. And the decision was made, there's got to be a better way to produce a result, which is, frankly, expedite and clean up landfills and get it fixed. So I just referenced that. I'm not proposing a fund. I don't have that. What I'm suggesting is that I think there are times where if you look at a situation and where we're at in it, perhaps we need to look at a different alternative than litigating it through, because I don't think it's going to produce a good result if we litigate it through in many of these cases. It just flat isn't, and it's going to take a long time. So I think between that and lastly, and again, I don't have a proposal, but from our industry's perspective, looking at alternatives to civil litigation, I think may well be more productive for the people impacted here. Some sort of a new hybrid, compulsory, mandatory arbitration system. There's better ways to cut the apple, I think, and get money to the situation that needs money as opposed to litigating it through. And this may be one of them that necessitates that. I don't have a proposal that accomplishes that. I think that would be productive to look at that and should be looked at. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll end up. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Goodwin, then Sikora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, there's a few things about what you just said, some of it which pertains not at all to this bill, I might add. But now that this bill has been amended to be, I'll say this nicely because I don't want to offend Representative Klinsing, but now that this bill has been amended so that it does almost nothing.
That would offend me.
That's offensive. Sorry.
That's fine. That's fine.
Compared to the problem.
Okay.
It really doesn't do much, and it doesn't even award attorney's fees anymore. It really does almost nothing. And I'm wondering, and you said you have no proposals to do anything for the homeowners. So basically what you're saying is don't do anything. In the meantime, the insurance industry is refusing to pay for these homes and leaving the homeowners out in the
on their own in the cold. You're not doing anything to fix the problem or work with the contractors and builders that I know of so that people can trust in buying a home and getting home repairs and so forth. But you're criticizing at this point something that isn't even in the bill. So I expect this, quite frankly, of the insurance industry. But I wish you would approach this in a different way. I truly wish that you would come to this committee with some ideas about how to help the homeowners here once in a while instead of coming always with protection for even more protections for the insurance industry and absolutely no ideas about how to help the homeowners. So I guess I would challenge you to come back with some ideas on how to help the homeowners here.
Thank you. Any response, or we go to Representative Sikora? Representative Sikora?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, I'm not even sure how to ask this question, but what I'm trying to better understand is what are the implications kind of across the industry? What are the implications for homeowners? I know just because we had a couple of hailstorms in my area that most of the homeowners I know have seen their insurance double. You know, what is the implications of something like this, which is a lot more expensive than putting on a new roof in most cases?
Mr. Johnson?
What are we looking at for the future here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't think that, this bill as it sits today, targets narrower issue, so I don't know that there's a broad implications. Unfortunately, the storms of the summer of 1998 had a whale of a lot bigger impact on premiums since some $1 billion in claims got paid out of that. That was significant Minnesota paid dollars that significantly upped homeowners' rates. But I think this is a narrower issue. I think that the challenge here is to try to figure out a better solution to people being in homes where you have these defects, where there may not be liability on the builder's part. The point is this, that there's a litigation going on with a bad situation in a home. But I should have commented, Mr. Chair, but that there's a notion that a liability policy is just like a warranty policy. It's a first party. This is a liability policy. It pays if there's fault. So it's not an automatic. You don't start writing checks because there's damages to a house. There's only checks written if there's negligence on the part of whoever bought the policy. And that's not clear in these cases. That's why I'm suggesting that we need some alternative to civil litigation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, do homeowners' policies ever cover the kind of damage that is created by maybe some negligence on the part of the builder but shows up 6 or 7 years later? Does homeowners cover that?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Never?
No. Unless there is a covered loss under the terms of the homeowners insurance contract, any kind of maintenance-related issues, those are not covered under homeowners' policies. If I have siding and it fades, that's not a covered loss. So there are a number of instances that it's just my obligation as a homeowner to upkeep and repair and do maintenance. None of those are covered claims, not in Minnesota and not in the other 49 states. So this, and the subset of that you're asking is potentially about mold-related issues, and mold issues are not covered issues under homeowners' policy. Mold, the kinds of losses, if any of you here look at the terms of your homeowners' policy, it defines what a covered loss is. And mold is not a covered loss under the terms of those.
Representative Sikora?
Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, I know you're in a hurry. I thought that if you had a leak in your roof or something like that, that you could have a claim on your homeowner's insurance. And if you can't have a claim on your homeowner's insurance for anything you were supposed to have done yourself, the only thing my homeowner's insurance is good for is if the house burns down.
Mr. Johnson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's the whole series of covered losses, but fire, storms, there's all kinds of damages that can happen to a house. So there's just, by the terms of the policy, the maintenance-related issues are not covered, period. They're just not.
Representative Sikora? Representative Rukavina, Linder, and Gunther. Representative Rukavina.
Well, first of all, Mr. Chair, at the risk of ruining my reputation, I have to admit publicly that I like Bob Johnson.
Oh, boy.
He's a nice guy, and I wish he worked for the AFL-CIO instead of the insurance industry. That's the only problem. Yes, but, I've heard and you were here, Mr. Johnson, about testimony. I believe it was Zurich Insurance Company that, you know, sold insurance to a lot of these builders, and they bought it and paid in good faith a premium with the assumption that if they ever got sued or whatever, that they'd pay out, and then I assume that the insurance company would go after what we've heard, window evaporators or whatever, and last Thursday that there were a lot of problems with some types of windows that were manufactured, and go after them. But you know, it's not working out that way, and these are sad stories to listen to. This issue has been actually around, this mold issue, and that Representative Evans in the past, Representative Goodwin, has worked on it. Now we've got a new representative working on it. But the bottom line is, we hear from the insurance industry always around here, if, you know, there's a big problem, if it isn't solved, these insurance companies aren't going to do business in the state of Minnesota. You brought up a good example, Mr. Johnson, with the petrol fund. And there it was, the consumer. All the consumers in the state of Minnesota, for these people in the audience now that they're probably wondering what you were talking about, when you buy go to the gas station and buy a tank of gas, there's a little surcharge. It's like the half a cent. Two cents. It can kick up and down depending on how much they need in the fund. And all of us consumers pay for those little gas station operators that thought they had insurance years ago when their tank systems failed. And then we've had workers' comp. Nobody's going to sell insurance in the state of Minnesota, workers' comp insurance, because Minnesota's, you know, we used to tell people when they got hurt at home, crawl to work so you can file a workers' comp claim. Now we tell them, crawl home so you don't have to file a workers' comp claim, because that system has gotten so bad because of the 95 law that rates are going up again, and no injured workers are covered anymore. So what's the solution here, Mr. Johnson? Like Representative Goodwin says, and I don't want to beat up you because you're a nice guy. You are. I just wish you worked for the union or somebody instead of the insurance industry. But what's the solution? Do we tax all of us like a petrol fund then, and do we have a state fund that takes care of these people? Because obviously the insurance industry isn't taking care of them, and now you've just told us that if we do this bill or anything else to try to help them, nobody's going to sell insurance to these builders. So do we have a, and then I'm perplexed, Mr. Chair, I got to say I'm perplexed, because I mean, no, the Republicans have a bill to stop people from being able to max out on a claim for a medical malpractice. I think Representative Bradley has it at $200,000 or something?
$250,000.
What is that?
$250,000.
I mean, if they cut your head off instead of your foot, you can only go up to $250,000. So you're limiting.
They cut your head off.
Yeah. Depending on whose head.
Well, my body might function better if you had.
You'd be fine.
Now you've got a bill where you're trying to open up so everybody, you know, there's no limits. So I'm kind of just confused. Why don't we do something like we did with the petrol fund? Why don't we put a tax on all building material, a half a cent or a quarter cent or whatever, put it in a fund, and that'll be the insurance for all the homeowners in the state, and the builders can put a little bit of the money in, and we'll take care of the problem. Because we've just heard today, members, that if we go ahead with Representative Clinton's bill, as watered down as it is, that now, with these amendments, that the insurance industry isn't going to sell insurance in the state of Minnesota to these builders. So maybe that's what we should do, and we should probably do it right here. Maybe if somebody can come up with an idea.
Mr. Johnson? Mr. Chairman, Representative Rooker, I think there's a question there for me about that maybe I can comment on. I haven't said that the work comp market is anywhere near the conditions, a healthy competitive market in Minnesota, as is auto and homeowners and life. And some markets are not. This is one. And I didn't say they'd not write. I said this has been a diminishing market nationwide and in this state, unrelated to this bill. And I described that as being a condition or a result of a lot of factors coming together, one of which is that the coverage litigation under this construction defect is just an enormous problem. So I'm not blaming, I'm just describing the condition of the market. And I'm suggesting that I think the marketplace needs to, and oftentimes in a competitive marketplace,
it does evolve to something different. So we have healthy competitive markets here. I describe them that way usually. These are the exceptions. Medical malpractice was one. This is one. But it's a real issue because there's builders out there and subcontractors and a lot of people that are looking for insurance. And if there's money to be made, Mr. Yeah. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, companies will sell it if they can make a buck. And if they can't, they won't. And I believe that. I think that's the case. But and it's diminished in recent
years. That's the failing part of capitalism. You know? I mean, that's the way it doesn't work. And then you expect us to come in government to take over for the petrol fund as an example.
No, Mr. Chairman, I wasn't. Johnson. I said I don't have a proposal on it. I use it as an example where I think the litigation mess caused a conclusion to do something differently. I also suggested that there are other alternatives that may be a better way to go than civil litigation. So I've been trying to be helpful to suggest I don't have a proposal for that, but I don't. I'm willing to work on that, and I think we need to look at that because I don't think the civil litigation route is going to produce a good result for the people involved here.
Representative Rukavina?
Well, Mr. Chair, just opposing Mr. Johnson, you're a very bright person, and I really did mean that you're a nice guy, and I do mean that. So maybe you can put your thinking cap on and you can go back to those big boys you represent and you can figure out a way to help the people that are sitting behind you accomplish their goals and the builders, because you're right, what's happening today isn't working. They're still paying out of their pockets for insurance. These people are, you know, trying to get their houses fixed and the problem isn't being solved, and this bill is probably not going to do it either, and it may be a first little step, but now you're warning us that it might also be a step where none of them are going to be able to build a home. So maybe a good idea. You've come up with them in the past, and I know you've probably come up in the future.
Okay, we have Representative Linder, Gunther, Dorman, Vandeveer, Mullery. Representative Linder.
I just about forgot what I was going to say.
Representative Gunther. No, Representative Linder.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I too think Mr. Johnson is a very nice guy, and I hope he stays in the position he's in, and the unions don't get him. But you know, I was just thinking, even the little small house I got. You know, when I first moved there about 18 years ago, I think my insurance was $200 a year, and now it's $1,000 a year. I've never filed a claim, even with all of the hail damage. I replaced the roof and paid for it myself. Didn't file a claim, but. You know, so many people are sort of like me. I don't think I've ever read an insurance policy that I've got, you know, the fine print. And so, you know, we're thinking that we're covered for a lot of things when we're really not. And I don't know, listening to people with a $400,000 or $500,000 house with $200,000 or $300,000 worth of repairs, what's the purpose in having insurance if you don't step up to the plate and pay your part? So maybe you're only liable for $100,000 of the $200,000. How come they're not cutting a check for that? And all of this running around that's driving up the cost of all of this, and the people just, you know, going away very unhappy. And
well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Linder, I think that I think you're putting on the table both homeowners insurance policies, which should take off the table. I think for purposes of what this whole debate has been, defects in the building of a home that have caused, you know, these terrible situations in homes, and is there somebody liable for that defect? So it's on that liability insurance policy, and it's maybe in the nature of that policy. Most people don't know what that is because I buy an auto and a homeowner's and life insurance. I don't buy a liability policy unless I'm running a business. So part of that is that consumers are interacting with the liability insurance mechanism. And the point of the matter is that that policy, by the terms of it, the terms of that contract, don't kick in unless there's been negligence on the part of the business who bought it. So the problem, and that's the one of the terrible, you know, difficulties of this situation. And I don't know how you sort through this. I think a lot of smart people I've talked to, and it's difficult to determine if a builder has built it to code and it's been inspected and cleared, and they move in, are there any defects in it? There may not be any negligence in the construction of that home, in which case that policy does not kick in. There's no obligation to pay any money. So part of that is understanding the nature of what contract here is being talked about here. And that's what I'm suggesting, is that contract covering the building construction risk is proving to be a problem nationwide. This is not unique to Minnesota. I'm just saying that so the nature of that risk, and I think it's exacerbated in Minnesota, though, and it's different because, as the builders have and others have testified, there are issues directly related to the code, energy codes in the state that are surely not the same in Atlanta and many, many other states of this country. So we do have specific issues to Minnesota related to how homes are constructed. And that may be a substantial contributing cause to the loss. But if there's nobody negligent, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lindner, then there's no coverage under that policy. That's the dilemma, as I talked about how the unfortunate situation, we may need to look at alternatives to that.
To that point, Representative Vandiver, Chairman Lindner still has the floor. Representative Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, to that point. I understand the difference between insurance, but what we're talking about is a statutory home warranty. So when my fuel pump goes out on my car, if it's under warranty, nobody goes out and tries to determine why that fuel pump went out. I have a warranty, put the pump in. And that's what, and the insurance is just backing the warranty for the builder, is it not? I mean, or maybe we should do it that way, because if you're buying a home warranty, the builder's paying for a warranty, he's paying a premium for a warranty, the homeowner said they have a warranty, they weren't told they had liability insurance. That's a separate issue, and we understand that. Are we mislabeling what this, when we call it a statutory home warranty, are we mislabeling that?
Mr. John.
Mr. Chairman, the builders can better address this. I think the answer is yes, you are, because that statutory warranty, I believe, if somebody in the back will nod or shake their head if I'm wrong, is not insured. Most of them, the builders self-insure that statutory warranty. In other words, there isn't a policy underlying that. So it's not the insurance mechanism that's kicking in there. I believe they would tell you that the statutory, what we're talking about, separate from that, is this construction defect issue and in the construction, and that's what the liability policy attaches to, not the statutory warranty. I think the builders can describe, I think what I described is an accurate description of how that works. So the liability policy is not relevant for what you asked.
Okay. Here's what we're going to do. We're running out of time. It's kind of short notice to call another meeting for tonight, so I'm going to back off on that. I'm not going to do that. Representative Klensing, this has to go here, you know, passed on the next six committee meetings sometime. And then it has to go civil law, correct? Mm-hmm. Any place else? I'm just thinking about time here.
Mr. Chair, it also has to go to local government.
Local government. Here's the plan. I just came up with a plan. We're going to adjourn for the day. We're going to come back Thursday. We'll have the PUCC bill, the tourism bill, and then we'll continue work on this. People have to get home and pick up kids and things like that. And so we're not going to do that today. We're not that far into the session to be doing that. But I think we're still fine on time. But if you could work on some of these issues, we will pick up with Mr. Johnson on Thursday with Linder, has the floor, Gunther, Dorman, Vandiver, Mullery. And if we can get some of this worked out in the meantime, that would be a great thing. So the first bill we have Thursday will be the Pew bill, so it's non-controversial and well thought out and a good piece of fine legislation. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.